Welcome back to The Hemingway List, the podcast where we go from literary zero to literary hero in 16 books flat. I'm working on it. I'm working on a new little catchphrase. It's not quite as catchy as the War and Peace one, but we'll get there. So, a lot of discussion about the first chapter, which is awesome. I'll tell you what, it was pretty nerve-wracking because I recorded the first chapter podcast and I threw a few questions out there and then I made the subreddit post, the discussion post, and I hit submit and then it was all quiet for I think like 3, maybe 4 hours before anyone put up a comment. And I was kind of nervous, to be honest. I mean, there's 1,728 followers on the subreddit, and there's about 1,400 subscribers on Podbean to the podcast, and there's more on other things, iTunes and that kind of stuff. So there's plenty of people listening, but I just had this kind of irrational fear of like, what if no one's interested anymore? What if now that War and Peace is finished, no one cares? And so there was like 3 or 4 hours where the discussion post just kind of sat there vacant. And I was thinking to myself, well, I was thinking, you know, everyone's in America. Not everyone's in America, but a lot of the listeners are in America or in the UK or, you know, across the pond. So they're all probably still asleep. I get a lot of my listens, most of my listens overnight while I'm asleep. So I was kind of reminding myself that, but there was also this little part of me that was like, what if no one comments? What if no one has anything to say about this first chapter? Then what am I going to say in the next episode? But then I woke up the next day, today, and there's 37 comments about the first chapter. So there's been some really good discussion, which makes my day. Before I jump into it as well, I'll just say I do apologize. You might have noticed that this episode is being posted a bit later than the first episode. Actually, it's more the case that the first episode was I posted that a bit earlier than usual. Typically, I do the podcast. It's sort of the last thing I do for the day. So it's usually at about 11 or even midnight by Melbourne time. So what that means is from here on, they'll probably be more regular. So the first one was a bit earlier than usual, give or take an hour or so. I don't do it at exactly the same every day, but around about the same time. So yeah, expect them every 24 hours-ish from this time. All right, so the questions I asked were, who do you think is calling the shots in this chapter? How did you find the prose style so far, and did any of the lines stand out as particularly well written? I also asked if anyone's come from War and Peace, from the previous project, what are your thoughts on the contrasting styles, and who is your favourite character so far? A lot of conversation around those questions and other questions. Marigold the Fields said, and Marigold the Fields, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being the very first comment that I'm going to read. Marigold the Fields says, I think the ocean is calling the shots in this chapter. The ocean is the reason their ship sunk and is tossing their lifeboat around like a toy. If they can't reach the house of refuge or the life-saving station, it's likely they'll all die. I liked the prose style. It immediately let us know that we're on a small boat in the middle of a choppy sea with 4 members of a ship's crew and little else. It doesn't waste time on the characters' backstories or what they're wearing or other details to help set the scene, because that's not important right now. My favourite lines are, there was a terrible grace in the move of the waves, and they came in silence save for the snarling of the crests. And the correspondent, pulling at the oar, watched the waves and wondered why he was there. I haven't read War and Peace, so I can't compare the two writing styles. Right now, my favourite character is the cook. He seems to be the most optimistic of the group, believing that once they get past Mosquito Inlet Light, they'll be rescued. What has happened, 22 said, I too liked the cook. Mostly because he said God, which I previously thought was only said by Napoleon Dynamite and other disgruntled high schoolers. Welcome to the podcast, What Has Happened, 22? Laura Y. Stitch said, I love your answer, Marigold the Fields, that the ocean is calling the shots. It's definitely the case. Agree with you, said, I love you both. Nice. There's a lot of love going around. Good to see. Befalgren said, I agree. It's very man versus nature. Why to a war said, am I the first to comment? That is insanely intimidating. Edit, I'm the second. All pressure is off. I think while Why to a War was writing the comment, someone else snuck in another comment. But nevertheless, thank you, Why to a War, for, for stepping up and being the first to type out a comment. Or the second. Still, I appreciate that. Like I said, I was kind of like biting my nails waiting for someone to comment, so I appreciate someone sticking their neck out and you know, going first. Why to a War said, welcome everyone, good luck. Thank you very much. I'm enjoying the prose. There's no refuge from the storm, and we're hit by alternating waves of descriptions of how overwhelming the sea is and metaphors for how small and powerless the boat is. A bathtub, a bronco, a dinghy, against it. At this point, the character I'm most interested in is the captain. What brought him to the state he's in? Will he snap out of it and save the day? Are they going to need a bigger boat? I love it. We're one day in, one chapter in, and we've already had a Jaws reference. Can't beat that. Oh, this is an interesting username. 14843759283. AKA Long String of Numbers said, I think I agree with you about the captain being the most interesting character so far. The way it describes his melancholy and self-reflection, after what we can presume is the loss of the ship he cared deeply for, is unique among things I've lately read. And the way I can imagine the tenseness of the tone of his voice as he speaks to the oiler helps add much to the overall atmosphere of the scene. It seems like there is a lot he can add to the story. Why to a War said, yes, this precisely. I get the impression that being incapacitated is very much the opposite of his natural state. Yeah, I get that feeling too. And I've got to comment and say that it was a really good pickup by Why to a War about those alternating waves of descriptions being a sort of metaphor for how the sea is hitting them in waves. That was really cool. I hadn't really noticed that until I read your comment, and definitely I can now kind of see that. Sue Dynamic. Hey, Sue Dynamic, welcome back. This is an old school original gangster of the War and Peace podcast. Good to see a familiar face. Sue Dynamic said, nobody seems to be in charge at the moment. The captain is still giving orders to the oiler, Billy. I like the cook so far. He seems to have a helpful outlook on the situation. And I love the line, the sun swung steadily up in the sky. Sorry, the sun swung steadily up the sky. And they knew it was broad day because the colour of the sea changed from slate to emerald green, streaked with amber lights, and the foam was like tumbling snow. Dog Soldier X said, as another reader said, I don't think anyone is calling the shots. They're all just at the mercy of the sea. If I had to pick one, it seems like the oiler, at least, is focused on helping them survive. The captain is incapacitated, and the cook and correspondent are arguing about whether or not rescue stations are manned. The oiler seems to be the only one focused on the here and now, as he reminds them, we're not there yet. I suppose the oiler is the character I'm holding out the most hope for so far. This is the first Stephen Crane I've read, and I do enjoy the prose so far. Me too. And yeah, I've got to agree. The prose so far has been... I don't know if it's because it's written in English and War and Peace is translated into English, but it is a lot smoother sailing, pardon the pun, to read it. Dog Soldier X continued, I like how both this book and War and Peace use the said he phrasing after a character speaks. It just sounds good to me. I like how the author has thus far left to the reader's imagination what exactly the characters and setting look like. So far, Crane seems to be sticking to the story at hand and not digressing into philosophical discussions, which I'm appreciating after the last few chapters of War and Peace. Yeah, hear, hear. I agree with everything you just said. It has been a very refreshing change. I'll tell you what's funny, though, is reading it out loud, even though it is in much clearer English and shorter, more simple structured sentences, I was still getting tongue-tied reading it. I think it's just because after reading the entirety of War and Peace out loud, my brain was just sort of trained to anticipate sentence structures in that way. And so I kept tripping over the sentences in this Stephen Crane in the first chapter. I actually had to edit out quite a few mistakes in the reading, which was interesting because the sentences were actually far more simply constructed, but just as I was in the wrong sort of muscle memory, the force of habit from reading Tolstoy made it, you know, it was like playing guitar with your left hand or, you know what I mean? It was just, it felt all out of whack, but weirdly, because by the same token, they were simple sentences. It was a strange sensation. Mellow Yellow, good to see you back again, says, doesn't sound like anyone is in charge, to be honest. The captain is injured and sounds distraught or traumatized. I didn't pick up on the traumatized. He seemed, and distraught. He seemed, you know, to me, like he was trying to keep cool, calm and collected, but he was like rattled. Like, deeply rattled me, but he was trying not to show it, even though he was injured. Which I think is a mark of a good leader. You know, to a certain degree, if he's properly injured, he's not going to be able to hide it. He has to acknowledge it. But by the same token, I think he was sort of trying to still seem like he was holding things together. The first line, none of them knew the colour of the sky. Ominous of a dark situation. Whoever them refers to, it doesn't sound like they're having a good time. It's quite a good opening line, isn't it? And Mellow Yellow says that their favourite character is the sea, or more specifically, the waves. C.S. Cal said, I like how you are thinking of the sea itself as a character. That's something I hadn't yet considered. Thank you. Very cool, Mellow Yellow. I agree. The sea is very much a character. And the setting of this story so far is very vivid. Techrific, one of the mods of the subreddit. Thanks, Techrific, for your hard work so far. Techrific said, I can see why Hemingway is recommending this story. We are straight away thrown into the action. The situation is dire. The characters are stripped down to their function. The cook, injured captain, the oiler, and the correspondent. The formal leader is still the captain. Keep her a little more south, Billy, he says to the oiler, Billy. The informal leader is to be discovered. I like the straightforward prose. Short sentences for the most part, very effective, almost clipped in some parts. The style is less epic than in War and Peace, and here, that's a good thing. And finally, Techrific said, the captain intrigues and worries me. Why to a War agreed, saying they liked that the characters are stripped down to their function. I like that too. Who they are and where they came from doesn't matter in this moment. What matters is survival and what skills or knowledge they can bring to the table and what's in front of them. He'll be Billy under the sea if they don't work together. My Pretty Power, welcome to the podcast, says, no one really seems to be in charge. The captain is currently in the background, and the others seem to be working on a consensus of their next steps together. I'm enjoying the prose, as it's fitting to the story, and the fast-paced, overwhelming style sets the hectic tone quite well. So far, the cook is the most interesting to me. His ideas and argument on their survival plans were the best they've got. Seems to me he may set their course. Happy Hog 1111, welcome to the show, said, not much to say, but considering it's the first chapter, I may as well make myself known. It looks like an interesting read. Welcome to the show, Happy Hog. Welcome to the book. And thank you for making yourself known. Soviet Mule said, I can strongly agree. They've quoted, I can see why Hemingway is recommending this. I strongly agree with this. I think it's a great opening. There's no messing about, no backstory, no setup, just a good solid opening, putting you smack in the middle of the picture. Within the first four paragraphs, we know what's going on and that it's a grim situation. I think the captain is the authority figure. He only says one line, but it's the only line of direction in the chapter. Well, that's a good point. Soviet Mule said, I enjoy reading it, but there are too many adjectives for me, just a personal preference. It's more of a tell style than a show style. Example, the injured captain. Interesting, I didn't actually notice that while reading it. I think, maybe because it was the opening chapter, you do tend to get a few more adjectives in an opening setting because you're setting up the character and the setting, right? So you're describing a lot of stuff in the opening chapter. And maybe also because it's a short story, it can tend to condense descriptions down. You've got to describe a lot in a short time. Might also be the reason why I didn't really notice that there was a lot of adjectives, but that's a good pickup by Soviet Mule. I wouldn't say that detracted anything for me, though. I actually thought it read quite nicely. I particularly liked the passage beginning, a singular disadvantage of the sea, .. and Soviet Mule's favourite character was the captain and the oiler. Techrific said, regarding the many adjectives, yes, that's a good point. Hemingway usually shies away from prose styles like that. I suppose he'd say it's too French or British, but I guess he liked the adjectives chosen here and thought them useful. We can only speculate. But on that's a really interesting thing to speculate on. Why did Hemingway choose these stories that he's chosen on this list? Already, just from the first chapter of this first book, I can see why he chose this one. Especially when you consider when it was written. I think it was written in the late 1800s. I'm just going to look that up. Yeah, it was first published in 1897. So, yeah, I can see... Tolstoy. Hemingway loved a good adventure, right? He was a great writer, but he also just loved adventure stories. And reading that first chapter, I could imagine, like, think if you were just a little kid in the early 1900s, right? A young boy or a young girl. And there's no games, there's no movies, you know, there's no internet. Video games don't exist yet for another 80, 90 years. But you can get a book like this, right? And just reading that first chapter, it's quite simple prose, quite easy to read language. You could imagine a child would be able to read that. But how thoroughly they would be transported to this place of adventure. I can definitely see the merit in a story like this. OMG, sign up already. OMG, sign up already. That's a good username. Got impatient making an account. OMG, sign up already said, I'm here. I like the last line in particular. We're not there yet, said the oiler in the stern. It seems to convey not only is the oiler in the stern of the little boat, but is also speaking sternly. It fits with the argument he and the correspondent are having. Also well spotted. A little play on words there, maybe, from Stephen Crane. Pauly95 said, "I don't think anyone is calling the shots. The crew seem to be in a state of disarray due to the captain's injury. His apathy from the injury has led to a gap in leadership and bickering between the crew. I'm interested to see if this resolves itself or only gets worse." I found the prose slightly abrasive. I felt some sentences ran longer than necessary. I will put that down to the age of the text and the vast contrast with what I'm reading outside of the list. However, I did enjoy the emphasis on colour, particularly the waves turning grey to green as a mark of physical progress and hopefulness. It's so interesting to read that you think the sentences ran long, and I think maybe they do by modern standards, but we've just come out of Tolstoy, and oh my gosh, these sentences are minuscule compared to some of the paragraphs in War and Peace. Some of the sentences in War and Peace are whole paragraphs. They take literally 40, 50 seconds to read. It's insane. Paul D95 continued, "It's early, and with not much to go off, I'd say my favourite character is the captain. He has a past detail to focus on and a larger responsibility than the rest of the crew. Crane also gives more attention to him than the other crew members, so most of my thoughts and questions would be about the captain." Swim, said the Mama Fishy, awesome username, said, "The prose, so clean and precise." Very much so, I would agree. Umbridge of Snow made an interesting comment, highlighting a paragraph. "In the wan light, the faces of the men must have been grey. Their eyes must have glinted in strange ways as they gazed steadily astern, viewed from the balcony. The whole thing would doubtless have been weirdly picturesque, but the men in the boat had no time to see it. And if they had had leisure, there were other things to occupy their minds. The sun swung steadily up the sky, and they knew it was broad day because the colour of the sea changed from slate to emerald green, streaked with amber lights, and the foam was like tumbling snow. The process of the breaking day was unknown to them. They were only aware of this effect upon the colour of the waves that rolled toward them." This whole paragraph felt like a very deliberate description of what a painting of this scene would look like, but at the same time emphasizing how none of them are capable of caring about it or even being aware of it right now, mirroring the first line, "None of them knew the colour of the sky." That's the most adjective-heavy section of the chapter, and it doesn't feel like excess to me. It feels like it's going for a very deliberate effect. I can definitely see that too now that you say it. You can almost see that scene, that painting moving in slow motion. Right, like it's a freeze frame so that the author can stop and describe it. Very, very cool. Planning for Burial said, "I agree with the others. The ocean is definitely in charge. The way everyone is reacting except for the cook seems to be accepting that their only chance of survival is up to the ocean. I'm enjoying the straightforward nature of the prose so far, and it's clear why Hemingway really enjoyed this short story, as it seems to be like it could have been an influence for how he wrote as well." Yeah, I'm starting to see that too. In fact, I could basically see that immediately. It's clean, it's descriptive, it's immediate. Grabber Apples said, "I love how the prose is focused on the sea, outright saying that the sky really isn't important right now, but for the shifting colour of the sea in the sunlight. The oiler seems the most pragmatic, more focused on getting over the next wall of water than what sort of outpost is at Mosquito Inlet Light. I like him a lot. Looking forward to more." Azuriga said, "This was a good start for a story, jumping directly into the heart of the action, quick tempo without sacrificing the beautiful prose to do so. I can't tell who is in charge just yet. It seems that the oiler's number one concern is keeping his head on straight and steady and being realistic with the situation. The other two are debating without reason. They don't know until they're there, and the captain is out of it for now. I highlighted one line I thought was fantastic. Thereafter, there was something strange in his voice. Although steady, it was deep with mourning and of a quality beyond oration or tears. I love the descriptive, visceral nature of the storytelling so far. And lastly, Azuriga said, I got to appreciate the cook's optimism, I suppose, in regard to who was their favourite character. Yeah, the cook did seem, well, maybe it was more wishful thinking than optimism, because he seems to think that the there's life-saving stations and this kind of thing, which the other guy is sort of saying, yeah, look, I think it's wishful thinking. He's pretty much calling him out on that. Evan DS91 said the captain is calling the shots. So far we've seen four characters, the captain, the oiler, the correspondent, and the cook. The oiler, correspondent, and cook are seen bickering at the end over where they should be heading, but earlier when the captain told the oiler to head in a certain direction, there was no question. Great point. Good pickup. The captain is my favourite character so far because of his leadership. Thereafter, there was something strange in his voice, although steady, it was deep with mourning and a quality beyond oration or tears. Keep her a little more south, Billy, said he. A little more south, sir, said the oiler in the stern. There's bravery in this statement. The men are bailing the water out of the boat. They are staring death in the face, yet the captain remains focused and calm. You can also hear the respect he has for the oiler. Keep her a little more south. This is such a kind and gracious way to give an order. Also, he is sure to use the oiler's name, Billy. To me, so much is said in this simple sentence. You're doing good. Don't give up. We can make it out of this storm. Thank you for steering this little dinghy with that shoddy oar, etc. I like this captain. Really, really cool. Evan DS91, the way you sort of unraveled that one little sentence and kind of extracted so much out of it, and everything you said seems evident now that you've said it. I think he is a good leader. And I was saying before that he seems to be trying to keep cool, calm, and collected, but I didn't really have an exact example of that. But the one you've pointed out there seems... maybe that was the bit that made me think that. He's respecting Billy. He is giving him confidence. He's continuing to lead. He's trying to make them worry less. He probably knows as well as everyone else that they're pretty much at the mercy of the ocean. Calvador said, I really love the prose style here. It's very unpretentious in that Crane says just what he means, but he makes interesting little connections and metaphors that make me smile or think, even if they're not crucial to the overall plot and development. It feels like a storyteller type old man is telling a good story to a child that he likes a lot and wants to learn, and he's trying to make sure that all the things that he noticed and observations that he made at the time make it in. That's a really cool way to describe the prose style. Calvador also singled out that quote about there being something strange in the captain's voice, how it was deep with mourning, saying, I really love this quote. I like that it's reaching at describing the captain's voice, but doesn't really know what's wrong with it. Additionally, it calls attention to sound as opposed to the light and colour that's otherwise so prominent. I thought this was powerful to imagine the captain saying this half drowned out by the sound of the waves crashing all around. It tears him down from his prestigious captaincy and puts him in the lowly place of just some injured guy in a boat. Even though he's giving commands, he's pretty broken. The captain is the most interesting going forward, but the oiler is my favourite. He doesn't quibble with the cook and the correspondent, but is instead pragmatic about their situation. He isn't bitter or upset or crying or otherwise. He listens to the captain and he maintains his sense of normalcy. Very cool. Calbador also said, I haven't posted much on Reddit in the past, and I honestly haven't read good literature nearly as much or as widely as I'd like, but I'm really excited about this group and being able to ramble a little bit. Hey, ramble away, Calbador. That's what we're here for. And thank you very much for your contribution. Right Way Up said, the sea with its waves and the captain with his directions are the ones in charge. MHM Matsk said, oddly enough, while reading this chapter, I kept thinking of the children's poem, Three Men in a Tub by S.S. Minow. Interesting comparison there. Wasm said, oh boy, that's a really pretty looking chapter. Maybe it's my bias showing in favour of the sea, but it pulled me right in. Don't know that I can pick a favourite, the optimistic, just keep bailing water out cook, the focus on what's going on and worry about things as they come oiler, the captain that still tries to give directions despite his injuries, or maybe the correspondent who I'm not sure is keeping it real or thinking the worst. Kinkar said, I echo the sentiments of many others. The ocean is calling the shots, and the men are at its mercy. I like how the prose focuses on the description of the sea over the characters. I do not feel any connection to a character for the time being, but I'll tell you who I don't trust, that darn cook. I understand he is just trying to offer some sort of guidance, but I don't think he has any of his facts straight. He is delusional and desperate to come up with anything that can possibly save his life. To be fair, I have a bias against overweight cooks stranded at sea after Life of Pi. Hopefully I'm proven wrong. I'd love a happy ending. Huh. You know what, that's funny that I've read Life of Pi and I've seen the movie, but until now I haven't even, it hasn't popped into my head. Like reading the chapter, I didn't get any imagery of Life of Pi. Such, it's so strange because it's so similar. Just goes to show the very different writing styles can evoke such different imagery, I suppose. Silver Lining said, what an exciting start. I'm drawing from the experience of swimming out too far into the breakers of a beach with no flags. Exhilarated, fearful but hopeful, exhausted though charged and focused all at once. Very cool imagery. I'm interested to see that that's not just me, right? Because I'm not a very good swimmer. I can swim, but I'm not a strong swimmer. And I've always gotten very sort of like, anxious in the ocean. Anxious might not be the word, but it's like, as soon as I step into the waves, it's like an adrenaline button. I get full of adrenaline. Right, it's very, well, exactly like Silver Lining has described. Exhilarated, fearful but hopeful, exhausted though charged and focused all at once. And it does feel like that, doesn't it? Like this adrenaline button has been pushed for all these men in this boat. All right, that was a lot of discussion. A lot of discussion. Thank you for sitting all the way through that. It was very interesting, but I've got to say that was a lot more comments than what I'm used to. If I cast my mind way, way back to the very start of last year, Chapter 1 of War and Peace, I think we had about the same amount of comments, 30, 40, maybe 50, and the first podcast was long because of that. I wanted to make my way through all of the comments, but I just wanted to also point out that this is going to be a much longer discussion than probably most of the other episodes, because what we will inevitably see, well, maybe not inevitably, but we'll likely see the amount of comments start to dwindle as we move forward for a few reasons. Firstly, because everyone's very excited because it's the start, it's the first day of the project, so everyone is excited to jump in and join the discussion. So that will naturally settle a little bit. And what else will happen is, you know, it's inevitable. Some people will dip out, you know, they'll give up. So, there were some chapters of War and Peace that had, like, zero comments. Like, literally no one had anything to say about the chapter. Typically, we'd have maybe, I'd say, 6 to 10 comments in the discussion. So that's just to give you an idea of, most likely, from my experience, how things will look going forward. The other thing I'd say is, if it does happen to continue at this level of 30 to 40 comments per chapter, I'll probably end up condensing it down a little bit and just reading, you know, 10 or so, because otherwise the discussion can tend to get a little bit repetitive. In the first episode today, I didn't want to, the second episode, I didn't want to sort of leave anyone out, so I tried to read them all. I did skim through some of them, and there was a couple that I skipped because they were very short and didn't really add much to the discussion, though I do appreciate those comments being made in the subreddit. Anyway, I'm just saying this to sort of set expectations for how things will look going forward. The typical War and Peace episode went for between 10 and 20 minutes, I would say, for the full episode, the reading of the chapter and the discussion. So as you can see, we've already passed that point in this episode because there's been so much discussion. The thing I liked about the first chapter, I've got to say, I very much like the prose style, and I liked that the setting was set without having to stop and describe it. It was kind of described during the action. You know, some authors will kind of pause the action and spend a whole page or more just sort of describing the setting, setting the scene, so to speak, and then they describe the action happening in the scene. Whereas Stephen Crane sort of described the scene throughout the whole chapter in just little bits and pieces. So he didn't have to pause the action at all. It felt very fast-paced to me, which is a good thing. He did exactly the same thing with his characters, too. They were described in very minimal but impactful details. Which I thought was good. So he didn't have to stop and describe what they looked like or what they were like, what kind of person they were. He's just doing that as the story unfolds. Alright, that is going to do us for the discussion part of the episode. Now let's move on and read Chapter 2 of Stephen Crane's The Open Boat. As the boat bounced from the top of each wave, the wind tore through the hair of the hatless men, and as the craft plopped her stern down again, the spray splashed past them. The crest of each of these waves was a hill, from the top of which the men surveyed, for a moment, a broad, tumultuous expanse, shining and wind-riven. It was probably splendid. It was probably glorious, this play of the free sea, wild with lights of emerald and white and amber. "Bully good thing it's an onshore wind," said the cook. "If not, where would we be? Wouldn't have a show." "That's right," said the correspondent. The busy oiler nodded his assent. Then the captain, in the bow, chuckled in a way that expressed humour, contempt, tragedy, all in one. "Do you think we've got much of a show now, boys?" he said. Whereupon the three were silent, save for a trifle of hemming and hawing. To express any particular optimism at this point they felt to be childish and stupid, but they all doubtless possessed this sense of the situation in their mind. A young man thinks doggedly at such times. On the other hand, the ethics of their condition was decidedly against any open suggestion of hopelessness, so they were silent. "Oh well," said the captain, soothing his children, "we'll get ashore, all right." But there was that in his tone which made them think, so the oiler quoth, "Yes, if this wind holds." The cook was bailing, "Yes, if we don't catch hell in the surf." Canton flannel gulls flew near and far. Sometimes they sat down on the sea, near patches of brown seaweed that rolled on the waves with a movement like carpets on a line in a gale. The birds sat comfortably in groups, and they were envied by some in the dinghy, for the wrath of the sea was no more to them than it was to a covey of prairie chickens 1,000 miles inland. Often they came very close and stared at the men with black bead-like eyes. At these times they were uncanny and sinister in their unblinking scrutiny, and the men hooted angrily at them, telling them to be gone. One came and evidently decided to alight on the top of the captain's head. The bird flew parallel to the boat and did not circle, but made short, sidelong jumps in the air, in chicken fashion. His black eyes were wistfully fixed upon the captain's head. "Ugly brute," said the oiler to the bird. "You look as if you were made with a jackknife." The cook and the correspondent swore darkly at the creature. The captain naturally wished to knock it away with the end of the heavy painter, but he did not dare to do it, because anything resembling an empathetic gesture would have capsized this freighted boat. And so, with his open hand, the captain gently and carefully waved the gull away. After it had been discouraged from the pursuit, the captain breathed easier on account of his hair, and others breathed easier because the bird struck their minds at this time as being somehow gruesome and ominous. In the meantime, the oiler and the correspondent rowed, and also they rowed. They sat together in the same seat, and each rowed an oar. Then the oiler took both oars, then the correspondent took both oars, then the oiler, then the correspondent. They rowed and they rowed. The very ticklish part of the business was when the time came for the reclining one in the stern to take his turn at the oars. By the very last star of truth, it was easier to steal eggs from under a hen than it was to change seats in the dinghy. First, the man in the stern slid his hand along the thwart and moved with care, as if he were of Sèvres. Then the man in the rowing seat slid his hand along the other thwart. It was all done with most extraordinary care. As the two sidled past each other, the whole party kept watchful eyes on the coming wave, and the captain cried, "Look out now, steady there." The brown mats of seaweed that appeared from time to time were like islands, bits of earth. They were travelling, apparently, neither one way nor the other. They were, to all intents, stationary. They informed the men in the boat that it was making progress slowly toward the land. The captain, rearing cautiously in the bow after the dinghy soared on a great swell, said that he had seen the lighthouse at Mosquito Inlet. Presently the cook remarked that he had seen it. The correspondent was at the oars then, and for some reason he too wished to look at the lighthouse, but his back was toward the far shore, and the waves were important, and for some time he could not seize an opportunity to turn his head. But at last there came a wave more gentle than the others, and when at the crest of it he swiftly scoured the western horizon. "See it?" said the captain. "No," said the correspondent slowly, "I didn't see anything." "Look again," said the captain. He pointed. "It's exactly in that direction." At the top of another wave, the correspondent did as he was bid, and this time his eyes chanced on a small, still thing on the edge of the swaying horizon. It was precisely like the point of a pin. It took an anxious eye to find a lighthouse so tiny. "Think we'll make it, Captain? If this wind holds and the boat doesn't swamp, we can't do much else," said the captain. The little boat, lifted by each towering sea and splashed viciously by the crests, made progress that, in the absence of seaweed, was not apparent to those in her. She seemed just a wee thing wallowing miraculously top up at the mercy of five oceans. Occasionally a great spread of water like white flames swarmed into her. "Bail her, cook," said the captain serenely. "All right, captain," said the cheerful cook. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Very cool. I'll hold my comments for next episode. Jump onto the subreddit, r/thehemingwaylist. There's a link in the description to this episode. And have your say about what you thought of this chapter. I look forward to hearing from you. Thank you very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.